You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London. I'm Robert Bounds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the economic crisis has led to an exodus of Spaniards from their homeland seeking a better fortune abroad. We'll get an update on the economics of European immigration. And our editor-in-chief will join me in the studio in a little while. We'll give a roundup of the winners and losers in the all-important medal race, 2012's Olympic uniforms. Also ahead, we sent our Hong Kong bureau chief to read some books at a fair.
More than half of the new release during the year will be published to time to coincide with the fair.
And later in the show, we'll meet another one of our lovely neighbours.
Marylebone High Street itself, it's still unique. It's a fabulous place to shop and spend some money.
Plus, a chat to learn the inner workings of Monocle's Section E with our edits editor, Santiago Tartidi, and we'll play you a few songs. That's coming up in the next hour, right here on Midori House. But first, just after the top of the hour, the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said today that he was deeply disappointed by the Security Council failed vote on Thursday, but would press ahead to end the violence in Syria.
Yesterday, the Security Council failed to act to address the dire situation confronting the Syrian people. Although this was deeply disappointing, the Joint Special Envoy Kofi Annan and I will press ahead to try and end the violence and abuses in Syria. We cannot abandon our collective responsibility to enable a peaceful, democratic, Syrian-led transition that meets the legitimate aspirations of the Syrian people.
The United Nations Security Council has just approved a resolution extending the monitoring mission in Syria for an additional 30 days, which the US says would allow for an orderly departure for the monitors. A former Japanese Prime Minister, Yukio Hatoyama, has joined 7,000 protesters at an anti-nuclear demonstration outside his old office in Tokyo today, in a fresh sign that the ruling party he once led is fracturing over energy and other policies. Japan's debate over nuclear power has become increasingly heated following the current Prime Minister, Yoshihiko Noda's decision to restart idle reactors despite persistent public safety concerns following last year's Fukushima nuclear crisis. Law enforcement officials have surrounded the apartment of a suspected gunman that killed at least 12 people during a midnight showing of the new Batman film in a suburb of Denver, Colorado. The suspect's apartment building has been evacuated and the area has been cordoned off. Neighbors said they were shocked to find out they lived near the suspected shooter.
Literally just what I saw was they just started evacuating us. First they called us about 2 a.m., told us to stay inside. Finally about 4:30, they told us everybody we had a couple minutes to get out and leave. We got out and leave. They had the apartment surrounded. They had us all get to one side of the street. They moved us down a few more blocks. And then finally we saw one of the armor trucks, a fire truck.
The suspect's apartment is believed to be booby-trapped, so law enforcement may be at the scene for hours or even days. Russian authorities have today detained 5 suspects over attacks that wounded the top Islamic official in the mostly Muslim Tatarstan region, killing his deputy and raising fears of the spread of militancy in Russia's heartland. Tatarstan's mufti, Idris Faizov, was hospitalized after 3 powerful blasts hit his car in the capital Kazan on Thursday. A little earlier, the deputy mufti was shot dead outside his home. A protest here against 3 Olympic sponsors in London's iconic Trafalgar Square has ended with police arresting a number of demonstrators on suspicion of criminal damage. Spoof representatives of Dow Chemical, BP and Rio Tinto were handed oversized medals by an actor dressed as London 2012 chairman Sebastian Coe before being drenched in green slime. Greenwash, an organisation which wants the Olympics to be as environmentally friendly as possible, held the protest under the London 2012 countdown clock. And finally, an American man has used his own obituary to confess to crimes ranging from the trivial to the more serious, including that he had stolen a safe and, as a college dropout, used a PhD awarded by accident to get a job. Val Patterson, who died of throat cancer aged 59, closes by apologising to his wife for 33 years of smoking, which made him a so-called thief of the additional time they could have spent together. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. I like that last story. In further reading on that, I realised that one of the things he talked about in this death speech or this thing that he wrote was the fact that he was banned from all amusement parks.
I didn't read that one.
That's a biggie.
That is a very big one. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the phrase "Don't sweat the small stuff"?
Yes, I am.
That's a bit for me. That should kind of. I don't know whether you know she's getting a kind of cheaper tombstone than normal for that.
Yeah,
that's tough stuff.
Poor chap.
Anyway, that was the news. Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's just coming up to 6 minutes past six here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyoist. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντος τεκασίν, τέμα ον Monocle 24.
London Bo, as a Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδα, βουρεσε Monocle 24.
Londonist, Sie sind Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que você está ouvindo é Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você ouve Monocle 24.
Isso é Monocle 24.
Você está ouvindo Monocle 24.
Escuta Monocle 24.
Você está ouvindo Monocle 24.
Isso é Monocle 24.
Isso é Monocle 24.
Um Monocle 24, agora já.
It is Midori House live on Monocle 24. It's yet another piece of bad news coming out of Spain. After slipping back into a recession at the beginning of the year, about a quarter of the country is now out of work. But the lack of jobs hasn't stopped some from seeking a better fortune elsewhere in the world. Earlier in the week, new stats were released revealing that the number of Spaniards moving abroad for work jumped 44.2% in January to June. That's 40,625 people left in that period. But what happens to national economies during periods of mass immigration? Joining us for a chat now on the economics of it all is Ilaria Maselli, Research Fellow at the European Capital Markets Institute and the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels. Ilaria, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for joining us on the line. I want to kind of get a sort of visual picture of this. This sounds like enough people leaving to be leaving some ghost towns. Is that sort of the sort of physical picture?
As an economist, I don't see often the pictures, but more than at the numbers. And I think it's true. It seems huge in terms of numbers, even though I wouldn't worry, even though this news is making big titles now in all European newspapers.
So this, maybe this is the sort of people. I mean, I think Spain went from being a country of immigration to a country of immigration. So how many people went into the country compared to how many are going out? I know there was a building boom a few years ago, which obviously attracted lots of people. Is it just the people that arrived leaving?
This is very difficult to say, because, of course, many of those that arrived during the housing boom were employed in the construction sector, and now those people are unemployed. I think there are more than 1 million of them in Spain only. But as long as these people are now going to a country where there are vacancies, so let's say Germany, this can only be good for both countries. I mean, the countries of departures and the country of arrival in the short term.
And what sort of, I wonder what sort of, what skill set people are taking with them from Spain? I mean, are these perhaps people that worked in the construction trade, as we've talked about? Are they possibly economists like yourself? I mean, what sort of grade of job is leaving?
Well, I think there are not detailed enough statistics to say that, but I would expect a mix. Because right now the country is in total recession, so it's difficult to find a job in the construction sector, but in all other sectors. And this is hitting actually very badly the young generation, meaning that there are people finishing university right now that are having trouble to find a job. And these people are most likely to emigrate because they're young, so they don't have families or maybe partners to worry about. So for them, it's easier to leave the country and start again in another place.
Yeah, well, I was going to talk about the under 25s, as you were alluding to there. 52%, I think it's the latest figure, of under 25s are unemployed in Spain, which is a sort of fantastic figure, over half of people under 25. Is this sort of breaking families apart? I mean, I wonder whether it is young people being able to be starry-eyed and go off and sort of follow the bright lights out of Spain at the moment. I mean, is it the young people that are leaving?
First of all, a clarification, if I may. Unemployment rate of 52% among the youth doesn't mean that one in two is unemployed, because some of them may be still in university, some of them are not active at all, so they're out of the labour market. So it's
of working age rather than available for work.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's not that one in two is unemployed, but the one in two among those that are either working or looking for a job is unemployed. So it's going to be smaller than it seems when one reads 52% unemployment rate. Apart from this, once again, I wouldn't see it as a very tragic figure or a very tragic problem, the issue of the mobility, because I think the right way to see it is in terms of circulation, meaning that if these people go for some time, as long as there is recession in Spain, and then they come back in a few years' time when the economy is booming again, this can only be good for Spain, because these people will bring new ideas, and in the meantime they will not lose their skill, because when you finish school or when you finish university, if you remain unemployed for a long time, your skills will become old and they will not be useful for the labor market. So the fact of leaving the country to look for fortune outside, I think has to be looked in a positive perspective.
Be that as it may, though, we're always sort of told, aren't we, Ilaria, that immigration is the best way to kickstart an economy. We've been having that sort of discussion in the UK in the last week. I mean, as an economist, is that a sort of a golden rule, or is it a lot more complicated than that?
I think it's complicated in general. I mean, it's always complex. The economy is always a complex topic. But what is true is that population makes GDP higher. By the simple fact that there are more people producing and consuming, which is probably the concern in the long run. I mean, if many people leave the country, then in the long run there is a problem because the population becomes smaller. But I don't think there is any need to worry about this, because if you consider the United States, where we always have the impression that mobility is huge, actually the cross-country mobility is only 1.6% of the population. So at the end, I mean, if you look at the numbers, there is no threat to the economy, even in the long run, I think.
Okay, Ilaria. Well, thank you for mopping our fevered brow on immigration. That was Ilaria Maselli, research fellow at the European Capital Markets Institute and the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Coming up next, we'll stuff a few birds. Stay with us.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
What Cannes is to film and Venice to architecture, the city of Arles is to photography. Our Monocle film crew headed down to the south of France for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Arles, the world's leading photography festival.
Photographers love a group hug. There's a lot of talk of apertures and shutter speeds and white balance in bars and parties across town. Everyone's at it, shooting everything in sight. Everyone's got their eye on everything and how everyone else might be framing it for a shot. It's a life through a lens in Arles.
Monocle Films, focus on photography on monocle.com.
You are tuned in to Midori House live on Monocle 24. Now, this month, All Visual Arts in London presents the British taxidermy artist Polly Morgan in her largest installation to date, Endless Plains. Inspired by a recent visit to the Serengeti, this new exhibition is a vibrant yet ominous display and confronts the viewer with the uncompromising cycle of life, the predator, the parasite, and the prey. Monocle's Jack Phillips went to meet the artist best known for her use of taxidermy to find out how roadkill can become a beautiful object.
Contemporary artist Polly Morgan is best known for her taxidermy work, some of which is on display at her most recent exhibition, Endless Lands, at All Visual Arts in London. It is inspired by her recent visit to the Serengeti, and this show houses a whole host of beasts.
Generally, I think I use nature or kind of natural elements more to sort of express a feeling of continuity and sort of life after death, really, rather than... I think people look at my work and they think it's all about death. And I think that's to really not look beyond the fact that I've used dead animals.
A muscular stag takes centre stage as it lays strewn across a contemporary crisp white plinth. A fox wrestles with octopus tentacles and delicate drawings hang on the walls. They are provocative and beautiful, and we see the dead come back to life amid the intrigued onlookers, who cannot help but get up close to the majesty of the natural world. But these animals are ultimately dead. No mooing, oinking or barking to be found here. So I went to see Polly at her studio in East London to talk about the show. Her two, very much alive, pet dogs scampered around our feet as we did so.
Some of the animals are actually cast in silicone rather than taxidermy this time. Done some drawings as well, which are drawn from... Well, they're drawn in glue, and then I've scattered the ash of cremated birds on top of the drawing, so that it's kind of... The drawings appeared once the ashes have been scattered. So I've done a series of drawings of birds' nests, and they have the relevant bird taxidermied on top of the frame, and the nests are made of the cremated ashes of that bird.
The work is a result of the recent trip made by the artist to the plains of the Serengeti, what she refers to as a happy accident. The safari holiday became an inspiration as the artist turned carcasses of the wild into intriguing artworks. You are constantly confronted with the cyclic nature of life and death, as predator feeds upon prey and parasites the aftermath.
I just felt like it was quite a good summary of life, I suppose, you know, and the sort of cycle of life, which is really... present there is what I should say. You know, you see dead animals just as much as you see live ones on the landscape, and a lot of the dead ones had dried out and looked kind of hollowed out from within because the vultures go in through the stomach and hollow them out, and then quite often they just dry there and they actually look quite taxidermied. So you can see these skins kind of dried over the bones, and when you get up close they've got these big cavities from the stomach. So I was actually just as interested in looking at the dead stuff as I was the living, and I started making a piece when I returned, which was a stag that had been hollowed out from inside. So I used a different process of... it was a different taxidermy technique to the one I'm used to. I usually make solid bodies, but I had to cast this one in fiberglass so I could actually sort of get inside it. And I made this endless plane inside the stag where you look in through the opening where the stomach is, and there's a bat cave inside it, so there's all these bats hanging off the ribs. And I've got concealed mirrors in there that makes it look like it goes on forever. And I got ill as soon as I got back from holiday as well. My appendix burst and I had loads of complications. I got gangrene and stuff and peritonitis and became really ill. And I started thinking quite a lot about... I think some of the time I was just quite delirious and having quite odd thoughts. And I was thinking a lot about bacteria and about things... The fact that this organ had died inside me and that this dead organ was teeming with life in the form of bacteria. And just how one thing dies and it becomes a kind of breeding ground for new life. The relationship between a pest and a host, I suppose.
In these works, nature and artistic sterility clash to create something with dynamism and impact. The mood is stark, dark and ominous, and a series of piglets suckling at a fallen tree do little to lift the mood.
If I was to just recreate a very naturalistic scene of, say, piglets suckling on a large pig, for me, you know, it would still have that sort of sense of, like, slight... horror that you get from the piece that I've made, but I think for a lot of people it wouldn't, because when you see something in context you don't really look at it as what it is. You don't look at it as all these tiny little piglets actually kind of like sucking the life out of this bigger one almost. There is something a bit terrifying, I think, about the sight of a suckling baby, because it's like this kind of ripe plump fruit that's kind of getting bigger and bigger off, you know, sometimes something that's shriveling and shriveling. Not always, but that can be the case. I wanted the piglets in that piece to look almost like chrysalids or something that were kind of you know, slowly swelling up and transforming into something like a kind of metamorphosis. You can't really be sentimental about stuff like that. I think even if you were, you would lose that feeling very quickly because you just get numb to it. The more I feel much more kind of vulnerable as a sort of physical being, I can feel under my skin and I can kind of know what it looks like under there. Whereas before I had no idea what it looked like under the skin. Now I can very much compare it to other mammals that I've done and we're not that different. You know, I know what, I can pretty much imagine what I'll see if I was to cut open my own arm or leg or something.
The animals at this show take on a role. Characters, if you will, in a bid to explore the complexities of life and death. For Polly, this appears to be constantly fluctuating, as she uses the process of taxidermy to create a cyclic interplay between that which eats and that which is eaten. The process of making is important, and Endless Lands is a demonstration of the brutality of death, as well as the resilience and continuity of life.
Bodies are very beautiful and they're very intriguing, and we don't actually get to sort of handle animal bodies that much. There's something incredibly tactile about doing taxidermy. It's a bit like cooking or something, you know, you really, it's nice to feel it on your hands. You know, some taxidermists wear gloves. I would never wear gloves because I don't feel like I've got a kind of 360 degree kind of understanding of it.
Nice one, Jack. That was Jack Phillips talking to Polly Morgan about her new show, Endless Lands, and that's currently running at All Visual Arts in London until the 31st of July. It's 21 minutes past 6pm here in London, and it's Olympics time. They are upon us, and we couldn't help but notice some of the outfits the various nations will be sporting as the Games kick off. I've brought in our editor-in-chief, Tyler Roulet, and our PR supreme. I was going to say PR girl. I'm the PR girl.
I think that's just commonly known as,
that's my phone ring.
So. And what are we going to do? We're going to review the latest looks and pick the winners and losers.
Bronze, silver, gold. Em found this. You sent this to us in Zurich the other day as a bit of a news flash, which was on Women's Wear Daily, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I get so excited because I think every Olympics, this is like the Eurovision of fashion. It's my favorite thing. Yeah.
You can you can watch it with the sound off.
Yeah. And this we should probably establish the rules. We're looking at opening ceremonies primarily. Opening outfits you're going to be seeing pretty much what, one week from this very hour almost.
Almost exactly, yeah. I think it's 9 p.m. So you'll have 2 hours of warm up.
Yes.
And then so this is the smarter attire. This is the stuff that's possibly designed by fashion designers. This is the stuff that shows off. Yeah, it's kind of like a little bit of a brand, whatever, brand USA,
exactly.
Brand Azerbaijan.
Soft PR.
Precisely.
All the different designers in the world have been consulted about what they're going to do. It's the way the nation looks. And it's the first time you'll see it is when they walk out into the stadium. So it's kind of a big, for PR, it's like the ultimate PR.
Would you like to be PRing the story?
Oh my God, I would die. I mean, I'm basically going to PR the hell out of Australians' uniforms.
Okay, so we're going to start with the USA.
Okay.
So what do we think? This looks... I mean, look, this is Ralph Lauren, right?
This is Ralph Lauren,
It looks very Ralph Lauren, doesn't it? It looks very sort of New England and sort of... it looks very
It's Gatsby-esque, isn't it?
Yeah, playing a bit of tennis in the Hamptons.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be a little bit disappointed if I was Wimbledon, because he was rolling out kind of the same thing for Wimbledon as well. You have something that looks like the reptile, acting as a belt. You have, of course, you know, a large USA. You've got... you've got a jockey cap as well.
And there's a sweater thrown around the shoulder on the female model there.
There is. And
she looks like she's walking off the yacht.
Yeah, do you think that the women, Em, are going to be wearing... Is it a high-heel sneaker?
I'm going to say it's a white ankle boot. I don't know. What? I don't know how that'll go on the track.
Exactly. I'm not convinced about that.
And it looks more like running for a nail appointment than down a track.
Yeah.
That, to me.
Anyway, I think it's fine.
I think it's fine. I don't think they've pushed the boat out far.
They haven't.
And they've tried to be American casual. Just go for it. The Olympics are every 4 years.
4 years, that's correct.
Well done.
Well done. Where are we going next? Are we going to Finland next?
We're going to Finland.
Okay, I'm going to jump straight in with the white 3/4 length pedal pusher on the man.
Yeah, that's...
With the orange sneaker.
With the orange sneaker.
Now, these have been done by Halti, which it's a famous Finnish brand. They do a lot of outerwear. I have to move up beyond the waist on the same gentleman in the 3/4 pant.
We're all coughing slightly.
Well, yeah. Did Finland go to the moon ever?
Because that's
a moonscape top that he's wearing.
It says in the official release it was inspired by the rocky print of the Helsinki archipelago.
I think the official that was lost on me.
The official design for that colour is known as toner cartridge needs replacing. That's the official design. That. I'm thinking, I don't know, this is a difficult one for many of our listeners, but I would say it's a bit sort of hearsay. Mm. Or it's a bit like an S Club 7 reunion outfit there.
Yeah, S Club's good.
It is, but anyway, they're mostly in a classical, warm-up suit, track suit.
It looks kind of glossy.
Germany.
Wow.
I think they're going to be hot because supposedly the sun's going to come out next week. I'm not sure if it's going to be sunny and warm 1 week from tonight, but it seems to me that they're in nylon. Women in pink nylon, boys in...
blue nylon. Just
royal blue, yeah.
Not mixing up the sort of gender divide there too
And
much.
Let's just add a few more colours with a bit of gold, black and red with the flag.
It's very confusing. It looks very east rather than west. That
very east. Yeah. And how's the sound? Would just be swish, 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 wouldn't it? Just nylon swishing.
Crunchy.
Don't touch anything metal immediately. I mean, don't touch a javelin. You'll be...
No.
That's good for the high jump.
Exactly. Frankly. I think a lot of sweaty crotches.
Just generally. Should we go down under?
Yeah, we should.
Please. Can I just say, clear winner, come on.
Australia.
All three of us.
High points, I would say it's a full 10 marks just for styling alone. So we're looking at an image of the Australian uniform, which they've set up. I think it was very clever not to put it on a model. They've done this beautiful, our art director, our creative director, Richard Spencer, probably thrilled. It's this beautiful still life. It's a wonderful two-button, very classic blazer with gold buttons, sensible belt, a white trouser.
And of course, the Australian emblem is proud on the jacket pocket, and it's very good.
Done.
It's good, isn't it? It's gold.
It looks like it's a white Oxford shirt with a navy tie.
Yeah. Sportscraft is a 98-year-old brand from Oz.
Right.
So for us, it's quite a heritage brand.
Okay.
And they
ancient by Aussie standards.
They designed this.
World's oldest man sells clothes.
They designed this, and I loved it. Also, Dunlop Volley, the shoes, and Dunlop Volley is iconic.
You don't have to yell when you're on the radio. You don't have to scream all the way back to us.
I'm excited.
I know.
But they didn't get... They got kind of panned in Australia, the Australian uniform.
It looks very very Aussie. It looks very Aussie cricket team.
Aussie cricket.
Which is not a bad thing. They have the best sort of cricketing outfit in the world.
I think it's great.
And maybe their team. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Italy. So we've got a sketch. I'm not. It's Giorgio Armani. I don't think Mr. Armani did the sketch himself. He might well have done. I think perhaps one of the more disturbing things is it actually looks like one of those trannies that you normally sort of see on a ring road outside of Rome.
It looks like the sort of inside front page on an erotic graphic novel.
It does.
Looks like she's going to take all that off. This, by the way, is a sort of skinny white.
I don't want to go back to the crotch, but I think there's extra going on. It's supposed to be a woman, but you don't really know what's happening.
No.
There's not much room to manoeuvre in there.
No.
I thought.
And I think
if you're a weightlifter and you don't want anything to pop out when you're wearing something so tight.
Exactly.
So I don't know what kind of field.
And I think Italy's actually gone for your white ankle boot as well.
I think the
US team's not going to be thrilled about that.
Not a lot more to say about Italy, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Japan. All I can say is which way to the food hall? Because it actually looks like the women who work at Takashimaya or Seibu, right?
It's sort of basic, isn't it? It's a bit like a lawn bowls referee might wear that.
White trousers, a red blazer, two button, gold button,
a neckerchief little pocket square. The side on the lady.
So it means also she might work for maybe one of Japan Airlines, commuter airlines. Yeah.
And also a very sensible white jogging shoe. Doesn't do favours to men or women.
No,
it's not, is it?
It's with very much a sensible slack.
It's a Midwestern tourist in London, isn't it? That? Where are we going?
I can't
Canada.
Even talk about
you have to talk about Canada. I talk about Australia. Come on. You have to talk about Canada.
Talk about it and I'm writing it down.
This is, so we have, it looks like a combination of black, red, and forest green. Kind of the rug. They look like rugby tops. Massive maple leaf, just huge. And then there's a zip top with a huge Canada across the front of it.
Dreadful.
That was a kind of late Friday night. Kind of like, oh god, I forgot.
Maybe these have been done by Roots in Canada. Do you have your?
They look a bit Roots. They look very Roots.
I think it's Hudson. I think it's
Hudson's Bay Company.
Yes, it is Hudson Bay.
Okay, well, I think they could have pushed it a little bit further.
Yeah.
I think we've got time for a couple more. We can squeeze them in.
Jamaica.
Which are our sort of highlights of the rest of the pack?
Okay, you have to make another crotch comment about Jamaica.
Jamaica has a low crutch. Tracksuit bottom.
Do you think he just didn't pull them up, or do you think that's actually deliberate?
I think that's deliberate.
A drop crotch.
I think they've drop crotch, throw it out there, let's see what happens.
I think that's suggesting something about the type of man that wears it, isn't it? There's something about, like, I need this much space.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Well, it doesn't matter if I'm doing her.
Welcome to Jamaica.
Yeah. How may I help you?
Denmark.
Denmark, to me, is the fashion and PR winner with that shot.
Is it? It is. Well,
they could be working in this office, to be honest.
It's quite austere, though. It's quite austere.
It's not having any fun with it.
No, I think with Australia went for the still life, they got three fantastic, hopefully they're athletes as well.
They put them on a track.
They might be. But they look great. I mean, they look like they're going out for a very nice, sensible Friday night in Copenhagen.
They do. I think they're probably the scorers.
Yeah, and so just to explain, the gentleman is in a white shirt, a chino, a blazer, kind of.
I'm gonna say
green and gray.
A lightweight blazer.
He's got a sneaker on, and the women are in sensible black skirts.
Very streamlined, very minimal.
Yeah, there's a twin set involved.
It's elegant.
It's good. Whoa, the Philippines.
Can the Philippines hat have a special shout out? Because
what's that? I don't want to be.
It's the Paddy Ricefield's hat.
It's rice picking an Olympic event now.
Not great.
We should say, there's no, I hope people just know. I think people are just going to have to Google the Philippines Olympic outfit. That's basically the best thing to do.
Just, can you just update us? Who designed it?
Oh, Philippines is Roger Laurel.
Roger Laurel, okay.
Yeah.
Azerbaijan, we don't even need to discuss.
No. Well,
Netherlands, just before, I guess, because we've got the new, we're actually past news time, aren't we, Rob?
Netherlands looks a bit like, you know, kind of like when they revisit children's sort of soaps when they get older. This is kind of like...
Right, where are they now?
Yeah, this is kind of like Glee meets Dawson's Creek.
10 years on.
You can smell, they reek of jupe. That 80s fragrance.
I just hope they're all wearing that massive lily in there as like a pocket sort of like accessory.
Yeah, well, you know,
during the opening scene.
Big tulips.
Yeah,
the tulips.
Of course.
They're tulips.
Huge
big lilies.
Big lily. Yeah, famous for lilies. Netherlands. One flower. Netherlands. Go.
Orchids.
Also, South Africa wearing jeans. Let's just put that out there. I'm
right.
Against it.
Okay, and we're getting yellow.
We've got to leave it. Tiny Boulay, Emily Smith, thank you very much indeed for
have
talking
a great
through
weekend.
The Olympic.
I could talk for hours.
I know you could. I know. You're welcome to come.
Should we say to Rob that next week that we're going to be having live coverage of this?
Yes, we are going to be talking. Are we going to be talking live throughout the opening?
Yeah,
ceremony?
I'm going to be there. I am going to be in the Monocle booth at the ceremonies, and there'll be people back at base doing a full critique of this. We'll be revisiting our review.
Wow, white ankle boots. That's the real question.
It is. Have a good weekend.
You heard it here first. It's a flip-flop free zone. It's the Monocle booth at the Olympics. Coming up next, we shall have Jonathan Wheatley a little late with the news headlines.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 des.
This is Monocle 24.
Afton into Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the show, we'll speak to Santiago Tarditi, editor of Edits Upstairs, and we go to the Hong Kong Book Fair and we meet the neighbours. But first, as promised, Jonathan Wheatley with the news.
Thank you very much, Rob. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said today that he was deeply disappointed by the Security Council failed vote on Thursday, but would press ahead to end the violence in Syria. However, the United Nations Security Council has approved a resolution extending the monitoring mission in Syria for an additional 30 days. A former Japanese Prime Minister has joined 7,000 protesters at an anti-nuclear demonstration outside his old office in Tokyo today. Japan's debate over nuclear power has become increasingly heated following the current Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda's decision to restart idle reactors despite persistent public safety concerns following last year's Fukushima nuclear crisis. Law enforcement officials have surrounded the apartment of a suspected gunman that killed at least 12 people during a midnight showing of the new Batman film in a suburb of Denver, Colorado. The suspect's apartment is believed to be booby-trapped, so law enforcement may be at the scene for hours or even days. And Russian authorities have today detained five suspects over attacks that wounded the top Islamic official in the mostly Muslim Tatarstan region, killing his deputy and raising fears of the spread of militancy in Russia's heartland. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank Thank you very much, Jonathan. And you're listening to Midori House with me, Robert Bounds. And it's Friday, which means it's almost the weekend, which also means it's time to talk edits. That was a good intro, wasn't it, Santiago?
It was perfect.
It's Santiago Tarditi is here, our edits editor, and he's come to talk, I think, about underwater wine cellars.
Yeah,
before,
yeah.
So, you might pass me my drink.
I know, I brought you, even if we're going to talk about wine, I brought you precisely a cold beer, because everybody's outside enjoying the sunshine and having a drink. So
we've got to get into our idiom somehow, haven't we?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, as you mentioned, underwater wine cellars, the new trend. This guy, Frank Laberry, from Chateau du Coron in Bordeaux, has come up with this new cellaring service that should launch next year.
So how does this work? Is this like a central cellar that's underground somewhere, and it's the perfect temperature to cool wine, and it's nice and dark and all the things you need?
Exactly.
Or is
yeah.
he encouraging people to basically bore down underneath their houses until they hit water?
Well, no. He's trying it himself with 10,000 of bottles of his own wine. And this is happening on the coast, on the Arcachon Bay. And he's doing it at an initial depth of only 5 meters. But the plan is to go even lower, go to 25 meters, where their temperature is constant. There is no light. There is no oxygen, which is the perfect condition to age wine.
The perfect place to store unloved relatives.
Also,
yeah. Let's not forget that.
You might
need top tips, anyone out there.
Yeah, you have to share space with mob bosses.
Yes, exactly. But, wearing concrete boots.
Exactly. But I don't know. I mean, I read this story today, and at first it sounded very interesting, but then it sounded too complicated. This guy is gonna need robots that can go underwater and fetch stainless steel boxes that are specially made to stand the pressure.
This sounds like sort of how a James Bond villain might store his wine.
Yeah, definitely.
But first, before I kill you, Mr. Bond, I must send my robot down to get a bottle of Chateau Lafite Rothschild 62.
Celebrate.
Very laboriously. And meanwhile, you'll shoot me in the back of the head. And so what's the sort of layout? Is there any sort of vague cost layout for how much this is going to cost him and then the consumer at the end?
Yeah, so he's going to charge approximately 17 euros per bottle per year.
That doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah, but there is a minimum number of bottles you have to store down there. It's not like you can walk up with just a bottle
of
you
Jacob's
get
Creek.
At Tesco's and just like, hey, can I store this for 17 pounds? Yeah, he's going to do that. He's going to start offering the service that will officially launch in June next year.
And is there sort of a fact? There's a shop that's near us, isn't there, called Eurocave, which is all about presumably storing wine. It's all about the cellar. Is there sort of do lots of press releases and lots of sort of invitations come across your desk for things that are sort of weird, far flung, weird ways to store wine and care for your wine?
Not really. I mean, I think the whole process of storing wine has been the same throughout centuries. Basically, if you have your wine cellar, you just have to keep the right conditions and so on. That's why I'm saying that this is a bit far-flung theory, a bit too complicated. But it's also part of a new trend that is planning to explore the sea much more nowadays, that the land is becoming more and more scarce. People are starting to look into the sea or the ocean as a new land, so to say, where you can probably build apartments, buildings, and even the fish farms nowadays are starting to be set there, because of course it's the right environment for the fish to grow. It produces meatier fish, healthier fish, and it keeps them safe from predators or poachers. In fact,
I want to know one simple thing. You've got these bottles of wine. You're paying your 17 euros per bottle. Maybe you've got 1,000 of your best bottles down there. What happens if the water washes the label off? Imagine you're like, I'll just go get the.
You need to send a sommelier underwater.
You do.
Scuba dive and test them all.
A man with an aqualung on his back.
Something like that.
Pouring. Yeah, exactly. I sort of like this idea, but I do feel it's possibly kind of best rendered in kind of like looming Technicolor and put like in a spy movie somehow.
Definitely.
What about you? Are you a fridge man or are you an ice man when you're chilling something?
I like...
Are you 25 minutes in the freezer?
That's it. Yeah, 25 minutes in the freezer and
it's
then...
It's the poor man's ice bucket, ladies and gentlemen.
It is.
Well, thank you, Santiago. Do you have any more wine-related things? Are you going to ferry some more beers in here, maybe?
Well, there's a lot of wine outside, so yeah, I don't know if you can speed up the clock
I know what
somehow.
You're trying to do. You're trying to wine this up.
I'm actually just... Can I go, Rob, please? My wine's ready.
I think we've kind of heard enough, possibly about not Eurocar, but the underwater equivalent of a cellar. Santiago Tarditi, thank you as ever for your Friday burst of Section E. You're listening to Midori House, where we will be right back.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and, sometimes weird, tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
It's 18:42 here in London. You're tuned into Midori House live on Monocle 24. Hong Kong is Asia's conventions hub. This week, the hugely popular Hong Kong Book Fair is underway. Liv Levichnik, our Hong Kong bureau chief, went along to have a browse of the books on sale this year.
It's the time of the year when the wheelie bag gang is out in force. Thousands of little black wheels are rolling on Hong Kong's convention centre by the waterfront in Wan Chai. They're on their way to the Hong Kong Book Fair, the perfect place to load up the wheelie with book bargains. Titles on sale include everything from cookbooks to Chinese language texts to biographies on big business leaders. Now in its 23rd edition, the 2012 fair is set to beat last year's near 1 million visitors. Benjamin Chow is Deputy Executive Director of the Hong Kong Trade Development Council, the fair organizer.
I'm very confident that this year's attendance will be more than last year. One of the reasons why the show is so popular, actually you all know that Hong Kong is a small city with 7 million people. But last time the book fair attracted altogether 950,000 visitors, meaning that one out of seven people in Hong Kong, they will actually show up at the fair. One of the reasons why it's so popular because the show is of long history, 22 years. And also, the show is being held during summertime when the youngsters, they are enjoying their summer holidays and their parents are bringing them to the show to buy all the books they have to consume during the summer holiday or even during the year. And also, now that even the publishing industry time the new released to coincide with the fair date. So I gather that more than half of the new release during the year will be published to time to coincide with the fair. So I think all these add up and make the fair very successful.
With over 350 exhibitors from 23 countries hawking books this year, the output at the fair is sure to satisfy all tastes. Though much of the literature on offer is in Chinese, an entire section has been set aside to English language books. In both languages, children's books are doing very well. The fair has even invited British children's book author Holly Webb to talk about her work and to cater to the interest in the genre, while other subjects have fallen out of favor with the reading public. Stephen Look is the director of Hong Kong's Commercial Press, a publishing house putting out content in English and Chinese.
So far, we have been very satisfied with our children's book promotion. And of course, on the other hand, the business books is a disaster. Yeah, because you know what happened to the stock market, to the economic crisis all over the world, you know. So all the books on the economic, on business titles are not doing well at all. That is, we order a lot of books from the US, from many sources, you know, and they are not moving as fast as I hope they would. And that's why we are doing a few books on China, on Chinese renminbi going out of China, on Chinese assets, you know, the national assets, as well as what would be possible for China economically in 2034. So we are doing most of the books on the China-Hong Kong side. I guess as the stock market, the mutual fund books, the books on management gurus, no, they have been doing badly. And as you may recall, Steve Jobs' book last year came out in October. And Chinese titles and English titles together, we have sold over 20,000 copies.
Genres may go in and out of fashion, but it seems that reading overall is only getting more conventional in Hong Kong. Business is good for Swindon Book, Hong Kong's oldest English language bookseller and a local agent for international publishers such as Macmillan and Penguin. Annabella Lee is the executive director of Swindon.
Hong Kong used to have a reputation that we didn't enjoy reading as much as perhaps in Taiwan. But I think that actually people in Hong Kong are very attuned to what's happening in the world. And so people enjoy reading more and more so. Publishers are coming out with different editions, so it's quite attractive. People want to collect them and also to read. Two popular titles is What Money Can't Buy by Michael Sandel, and the other one is 5 Points Someone by Chisan Batat, and that's the basis for the movie of Three Idiots. I think people like humor, and because the movie is popular, they've been asking for that, and we're almost sold out of that book. We have 13,000 books. It doesn't look like 13,000 books, but there are 13,000 books here. And we feel that people really like to browse, so we have brought a variety of publishers' books. Because it's heavily discounted, people are very interested in buying right away. So I think quite a number of our, maybe 60% of our books will be sold. We actually focus on what we think people are reading, what are good books, and things, books that are attractive to people. Because we've been the most stable and the earliest English language bookseller in Hong Kong, we feel that the presence is important because we want to educate our younger generation that we're here and we have good books. Well, I think we have to know our customers, our customer base, and we try to bring in the books that we feel for a good international customer what we would like. But I think also the customers sometimes dictate some of the selections. For example, the hottest 50 Shades of Grey, and we do carry some of that too. So I think it's a balance.
The global discussion on how e-readers are affecting book sales and reading habits is raging in Hong Kong too. The good news is that Hong Kong booksellers so far haven't seen sales of printed books go down as a result of people reading on devices, which is an encouraging sign here. The local population is one of the world's most dedicated to a world on screens, smartphones and gizmos.
I think that increasing numbers of customers have digital devices, e-readers, but we also sell a very good device called the Kobo, and I think that it hasn't eroded our sales because there are more and more customers who like print books, but also parents prefer that the children read print books because they're on the digital devices all the time anyway. But we have to have a balance. We as deliverers of culture should make sure that we are part of it too. So we, whether it's print books or digital books, we are in the business of selling literature.
So, for the near future, we'll keep seeing, and getting run over by, the wheelies on the streets of Wan Chai in mid-July. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
And thank you very much, Liv Levichnik. That was our Hong Kong Bureau Chief on the city's book fair. From Hong Kong, now to a bit of Brazil. It's time for a song. This is Sun is Shining, Bebel Gilberto. And that was Sun is Shining by Bebel Gilberto. That sounds like a remix of a sort of remix which was by Bob Marley originally. The time is 1854 here in London and you're listening to Midori House. And it's time now for us to pop into another storefront in Marylebone, London, for a weekly section, Meet the Neighbours. Today we visited our local deli, Fresco's, a favourite among Monocle staff. And as we've learned, a favourite among them, among many an office worker in the area. The stress is on Lebanese street food, as it has been for the past 8 years. But their recent bet on having a dish of the day has been helping the tiny eatery stand out. The beetroot and plum salad started as a special and is now a daily request for many of the regulars. And here is the recipe for success.
Hello, my name is Saeed Lakhdar and I'm the proprietor of Fresco, all natural juices and food. Fresco has been trading for the last 26 years and in this area for the last 8 years. What I like about the area is the community is quite nice and people, it's amazing, even if there's lots of offices around here, but people know each other and it's very friendly neighborhood. We deal with a lot of people from offices around here, as you know. The residence is very small in comparison to office. The best part, we don't work the weekend, which is quite nice. As you know, in the catering, most outlets are they do weekends, and also we don't open evening. We only the daytime, which is perfect, suits me perfectly with a family life, and also the area is quite nice. We're very lucky; we've got such a fabulous parks nearby, and Baker Street is very central to come and go. So it's very. It takes me 20 minutes to go home, and it's really good. It makes my life easier. Yeah, Marylebone area is very unique. It's quite nice, and somehow it kept a lot of nice shops around, and some of them are very old, well established. In comparison to other areas, we've seen quite a lot of change, and a lot of those big chains they take over. Sadly, it happened in Baker Street, whereas there is all the big names and. That has increased lately, but Marylebone High Street itself, it's still unique. It's a fabulous place to shop and spend some money. Today we've got roast chicken with fennel and French beans with roasted mushroom and red and green pepper. It's quite nice. It's beautiful, nicely done and very light also. Me and the chef, we work together to create the dish of the day. The usual line, the falafel, and that's quite very well established. I think we're very well known for the wraps and the falafel and what we call it, the street food, Lebanese street food. The special of the day, it started a couple of months ago and it has been quite successful. With the recession, as we all know, it's a little bit slower than usual. There is a lot of people, even they still have a job, but they worry they may lose their job. We have seen a lot of people, they go for either cheaper option or they go for a small size drinks or they have a kind of a lunch, a small box. So we used to sell lots of large boxes, and now we sell more of the small ones. And also the cakes and things like that have slowed down a little bit. But then we are very competitive. The price, it's you can have lunch for $3.95, and that will give you four vegetarian dishes, and it's fabulous, and it's healthy. We try to keep away from frying, and we try to use the minimum of oil. We use a lot of olive oil, and all our ingredients is fresh. And the juices are all made to order, so they're all from fresh vegetables.
And that was Anna Franca talking to the proprietor of Frescos. If only we had a radio station that kept the same working hours as that restaurant. That's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Anna Franca, our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news, it's this week's edition of The Menu. Here's a taste of what's in store.
What makes the kitchen surfing experience in Berlin so festive is that most people are meeting each other for the first time, much like dining at a supper club.
And in just 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be here with the Monocle Daily. Andrew Tuck will be back with Midori House at the same time on Monday, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. This has been Midori House. Thanks for tuning in.